Paul comes to the Corinthians as a father. Father love he gives to the church. Father love is indispensable, is it not? Steve Martin writes in the Atlantic Journal this summer about his father, his relationship to his father. He said when his father died at 83, people came and eulogized him. They said he was charming, he was affable, he was generous, he was the life of the party. Steve Martin said he sat there and thought, not the dad I knew. He said growing up, his father never spoke a word to him other than a word of criticism, usually couched in anger. But finally, when he got to be a teenager, he just decided not to listen anymore. He said his teenage years, virtually not a word between he and his father. If his father walked in the room, he walked out. Even when he became a successful actor and comedian, when his first movie came out and the critics were raving about it, they said that all his friends threw a big party for him to celebrate the success of the movie, and they invited his dad. It was almost a competition to see if they could elicit some kind word from his father about the son. And all his dad was heard to say when they said, the critics loved it, everybody loves it, your son's a star, what do you think? All the father could say is, well, he's no Charlie Chaplin, I'll tell you that. But it went on his whole life. So late in life, he realized his father was going to die, had a heart condition, he was getting frail. But he didn't want his father's life to end without, you know, some reconciliation. So he began to move towards his parents. He began to take them out for brunch every Sunday. And he described that when brunch was over, he'd always affectionately kiss his mother. And he and his father would sort of exchange an awkward wave, and they would go on their way. So one day, he sort of reached out and shook his father's hand as they were departing. And his father pulled him close, and in a barely audible voice, his father said, I love you, son. Steve Martin said he stood there in the street, parents left, just frozen. And then a couple days later, he penned a note to his dad that started like this. Dad, the other day after breakfast, I heard what you said. I heard what you said, Dad. You know, that's what we all crave. Steve Martin craved it his whole life. We crave it. We crave to have a father, to hear his voice. In our case, through our stubbornness, through our willful neglect of that relationship, still we know we need it for God to break through and for us to hear his voice and say, I love you, son. I love you, daughter. Experience the love of a father. We need father love. Matter of fact, there's something called the National Fatherhood Initiative. I think Tony Dungy is actually a leader in that initiative. The National Fatherhood, you know, kind of grew out of the Million Man March and all these other things. We need men. We need men to stand up and be men. You know, and the National Fatherhood Initiative has three objectives. They said, we need men to be role models to their kids. We need men to discipline and correct and teach their kids. And thirdly, they said, we mean men to sacrifice and serve their family and their kids. Kids need that. Kids need direction. Where are they going to get it from? They need a father. Well, that's what we see in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, because not just kids need direction, churches need direction, culture needs direction, your office needs direction. Everywhere you look, father love is needed. And father love can only be brought by those who have experienced it. Those who have heard the father say, I love you, son, can bring it into their world. Now, right away, you need to know that it's not Father's Day. Right? If you want to shower me with gifts after the service, though, that's be acceptable. But it's not Father's Day. And this message isn't to fathers, and it's not particularly to men, either. Everybody here can show father love to others, because everybody here receives it. Everybody here can give it. Every pastor, every teacher, every coach, every parent, everybody who has influence on anyone else to be a recipient of father love and then one who is a conduit to others. Because our culture and our churches and our children, they need to know the way to go. Let's watch how Paul gives that father love that he received from the Father to the church at Corinth as we study together. Take your sermon outline. The first thing we want to say about father love is that it invites imitation. It invites imitation. Paul's rather bold when he says this. He realizes that the Corinthian church has lost its way. They're off track. How are they going to get back on track? They don't even know what the track is. They don't even know what the gospel life looks like. So what does Paul say? I'll show you what it looks like. Imitate me. Look at the passage typed in your outline. He says it in 1 Corinthians 4:16. I exhort you, be imitators of me. But then in chapter 11, he says, be imitators of me as I am of Christ. I'm imitating Christ, so imitate me. In Philippians 3 and 4, he says, brethren, join in following my example. Observe those who walk according to the pattern that you have in us. The things you have learned and received and heard and have seen in me, practice these things. Paul says, not only that, I want you to imitate me. If you want a picture of what the gospel life looks like, look at me. But since I'm not physically present with you, I'm sending Timothy. Imitate Timothy, because Timothy's imitating me as I imitate Christ. It's the responsibility of the leader, isn't it? To present a picture that others can follow. And it is also the burden of the leader, because people are watching you. And they will mimic you, whether you like it or not. Whether your example is worthy of being imitated or not, they will imitate it. It will be imprinted on others. Think of the father who had a terrible argument with his wife, and these words came out of his mouth as he pounded on the kitchen table. He said, "No, no, no, no! I won't take it anymore. I don't love you. I hate you." The other harsh words in this argument. A couple weeks later, when he was walking through his home, aroused actually late at night, because he heard a noise in his young son, his 2-3-year-old son's bedroom. And when he went to the door and pushed the door open, his son was tossing and turning in bed, having some sort of nightmare. And out of his mouth, his dad sat and listened, came these words from his 2.5-year-old. No, 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 I don't love you, I hate you. The father realized his bitterness, his anger, his unforgiveness had already been bequeathed to the next generation. Somewhere subconsciously, those words had found a niche. It's a terrible thing to be a leader. It's a terrible thing to know that others are watching you and they're being imprinted by you. And so what's of the essence is not that we behave outwardly right so that others who see us behave like that too. What's really at the essence is that we be authentic. Is that who we really are on the inside is worthy of imitation. That it sounds like when we say Paul says imitate me, it sounds vain, doesn't it? But it's not vain. It's what every teacher, coach, parent, leader has to do. It's not fair to say to people, it's not fair for the coach to say to his charges, make your free throws. I'm tired of missing free throws. They're called free throws. Nobody's guarding you. You should make them every time. My player's making those to give this kind of lecturing and hectoring and advice if he can't stand up there and show them how to do it. Right? Just to exhort them, but not to be able to say, here, watch me, I'll show you how it's done. Imitate me. That's what any leader has to do. The teacher teaching algebra, can't say to the kids, why don't you bet it? Try harder. No. They have to go to the board and they have to say, watch, I'm going to solve this equation. I'm going to solve this problem. I'm going to do it in front of you. What do they say? Imitate me. Learn from me. I can show you how it's done. It's not vain to say that. It's our responsibility. It's the responsibility of the leader. And we know that those who are watching aren't going to learn so much from what we say as from what we do and what we are. It's going to come through. So the parent who says, in this household, we have respect for authority. Right? It's their head. And then he stands at the fence at the little league baseball game yelling at the umpire. And the kids are learning what? Dad talks a good game. Dad wants people to kowtow to him, but Dad doesn't submit to the authorities in his world, God doesn't really believe in respecting authority. He's teaching us to, but he's really teaching us not to. Oh, is that not the burden of leadership? You know, that's the deal. You know, you can go to a mechanic and they could be a creep and still fix your brakes, right? They can be internally a rotten person and still produce a product that's worthy of paying for. You could go to a physician, a surgeon, who's immoral, cheating on their wife, a lousy person, and they might still fix your knee better than any other surgeon. But guess what? That doesn't work when it comes to raising kids. And that doesn't work when it comes to pastoring and leading and running an office and being a boss or being a supervisor or being a teacher or being a coach. Because who you are is really what you're communicating. And there's no escape from it. We have to be authentic. The gospel has to be happening in us. We can't just talk about it. We can't just have the truth. We can't just put on a facade. You know, if we're going to lead worship, it isn't just a matter of having smooth segues between songs and prayers and knowing when to get up and throwing little scriptures in there to tie it all together. If you're really going to lead worship, you have to be a what? A worshiper. You've got to be in front of people, and you're worshiping genuinely, not because people are watching, but because you're a worshiper. You know, if you want to communicate to your kids the vapid, the emptiness of the materialism of our world, then you got to get it yourself. And they're going to watch you, and they're going to watch what kind of programs you watch, and what kind of magazines you read, and what kind of shopping you do, and what kind of attention you give to outward appearance. It's got to be authentic. It's got to come from you, and it can't be puritanical. I never use credit cards. You know, and other rules. You know, and we don't spend on this. And we don't, you know, when we go out to eat, we always get water. You know, it's whether or not you really have joy in Christ, not artificial, you know, the artificial joy. And so there, understand what I'm saying? It's got to be authentic. It has to be in us. The leader, one who can say, I want you to have what I have. I mean, think of sharing the gospel. Is sharing the gospel a matter of sitting down with people and saying, you are a sinner? Let me show you that mathematical. You cannot escape. Here are the verses that you must follow. Pray the prayer. You will receive Jesus. Or is it a matter of saying, I know what it's like to live a life apart from God and to be pursued by God and to be captured by Him and to be experiencing the love, His love as a part of His family. And you know what? Man, I want you to experience that too. How much of our evangelism is argumentative, polemic, trying to prove people wrong, a power struggle of knowledge? And how would that be transformed if the people who are talking to their friends and neighbors and coworkers and family would just say, something rich has happened in my life. Gosh, I want it for you too. I want the sweetness of father love that I've experienced for you to experience it too. I know what it's like to be hungry. I found the bread. I want it for you. Listen, I know what I'm talking about this morning. You know why? Because I can look back in my ministry and I can say for probably half of the 20 years I've been in ministry, for the first 10 years, I knew the experience of telling people, telling this congregation, that there was power in God and that God would change your life and that the love of God would transform you. And all that was true. And so it blessed people that I did that. But you know what an awful thing it is to be telling people that and then to go home every week and say, but how come it's not transforming me? I don't really think I love people very well. I don't even know my neighbors. People I encounter in my life, I don't sense that my being in their lives really blesses or nourishes or encourages them. I don't sense that I am blown away by the grace of the gospel in such a way that my life is reflecting. I don't really repent of sin other than very generically. I don't, you know, I can say I'm selfish, but I don't know how I was selfish today. You know how rotten it is to stand up and preach and proclaim something and be able to say, I know it's true, but I'm not really experiencing it. That's an awful place to be. Many Sundays I would go home and say, I don't think I'm going to do this very much longer. Because there's a disconnect here between what I'm saying and what I'm experiencing. So I'm going to tell you, it feels awfully good to be up here these days. It feels awfully good to be able to stand in front of you and to say the gospel is really true. It's got to be happening in your life for you to communicate to other people very well. Parents are often, how am I going to get my kids to follow Jesus? I mean, that's a real, some of you, like Brian, you know, Brian could say most of his raising of his at least his older boys, he wasn't a Christian. He didn't go to church. He didn't know God. And some of you know the same thing. Some of you can say, I raised my kids in a certain way. I might have taken them to church, but our church, I'm starting to see now our church is messed up. We didn't get it. We didn't get it as a family. And now your kids are in their 30s and their 40s and they're not walking with Jesus. And you say, what in the world could I do about that? You know, it's not parenting like parenting an 8-year-old anymore. It isn't your kids that need to get it. Don't make that the object of your attention. It's you. If the gospel is authentically taking root in your life, in your heart, that you are being set free because you know that you have a loving affection of a Father because the righteousness of Jesus has covered you. Let me tell you something. Your life will begin to make shift that your grown adult children, I promise you, they will notice. I'm really kidding on thin ice here. But some of you may appear to your kids to have been a little like Steve Martin's dad. When you become a little more expressive and a little more affectionate and a little more encouraging, I promise you they're going to start saying, where in the world did that come from? The old man's a different guy. As the gospel takes resonance in your heart, it'll impact your kids like crazy. Let that be the focus of your life. This week, I saw it in my own home. My wife had an opportunity to get angry. She was disappointed about something that happened. And what did she do in that anger? She could have let that anger take root and be expressed in a way that was destructive. And she saw that happening in her life, and not because she's some great Christian, but just out of desperation, she went to Jesus instead, and she got real help from Christ to be able to deal with that. Now, you know, we want to be good role models. And so is being a good role model always doing the right thing? We've got to do the right thing in front of our kids and other than our students and our congregation and our life group. We've got to do the right thing. That's impossible. Some people remember my story about the father who got mad at his wife and the little kid heard that? Well, some would say, well, that just shows you that you shouldn't fight in front of the kids. Let me tell you something. It doesn't make much difference whether you fight in front of the kids, because I promise you, if you're alienated from your spouse, your kids will know it and their life will be affected by it. And if you don't fight in front of the kids, guess what they never get to see? They never get to see a real relationship lived out where people get mad at each other and then they have to say they're sorry and they have to confess and they have to reconcile. And so they have a false picture of what relationship is really like. If you think that's being a good role model, it just isn't. I don't fight in front of my kids. Well, someone says, well, you shouldn't fight at all. There's only one way not to fight at all, to be dead. Every relationship you have, there will be dissonance, there will be conflict. It is not avoidable on some level. And so when my wife found herself moving towards anger and she ran to Jesus, it just so happened that my son was there and he observed it and they prayed together. You see, she didn't say, let's see, I think this is a teachable moment. Tucker, come in here. Let me role model for you. Let me try to do the right thing in front of you. It wasn't like that. It was a desperate grab for Jesus in the midst of everyday life that he witnessed. he saw what real Christianity is, authentic Christianity in the trenches. It was something worthy of imitation. That's what Paul was saying to the church. Gosh, brothers and sisters, don't you want to be authentic? Don't you want to be a people? Well, I know the seven principles of powerful prayer. Who gives a rip? Do you pray? I can tell you all the Bible stories of the great faith. But do you have it? I can argue the five reasons for the existence of Christ. You know, I hope you can do that. That'd be good for you to be able to do that. But do you know him? Paul could say, imitate me. Imitate me. I want the Father love that I've experienced. Who is Paul? He was on his way to Damascus slaughtering Christians when God interrupted his life and snatched him and said, I'm going to make use out of you. That's all Paul's saying to the Corinthian people. Imitate me. I've tasted of this love, of this pursuing, seeking, loving Father. I want you to have it too. Second, Father leadership, Father love. That was the gift from God that we give to others. You can say, imitate me. Well, secondly, also, Father love provides correction. It provides loving correction. Paul tells the Corinthian church, I don't want to shame you. How many of you, we know what that is, right? We know what shaming correction is, belittling correction, guilt, mongering, you know. I think of a little girl I read, old teenage girl, got a mother gave her a new hair dryer, and with this gift of the hair dryer, the mother said, let's see if you can not lose this one. Let's see if you can not leave this one. You manage to not leave this one in the locker room like you have the last one, or, you know, so-and-so's house like you did the one before that. This is a gift for you. You know, your father and I sacrifice for you all the time, and we just don't think you kids appreciate it. We don't think you have any idea of all we do for you. So here's a gift. The girl said she wanted to throw it out the window. How much she wanted that gift. How much she wanted to know that her life was such a burden to her parents, and her failure was such a disappointment. She told her counselor that what she did instead, though, was she just shaved her hair off. I can tell you that we don't like to be shamed. But there is one group that does, interestingly enough. Religious people. We love it. We come every week to church, and if the pastor just lays the wood to us, you know what religious people say? Oh, oh, so good, pastor. I mean, the pastor just let her walk, do this, you're no good, you're going to hell, you got to, you know, we walk out of there, and religious people say, oh, that felt so good, that felt like my childhood, that was just good old-fashioned preaching, you know, took no prisoners, preacher. You know why religious people love to feel shame and guilt? Because they don't want to go to Jesus with their sins, they want to deal with them themselves. They want to be their own saviors. And they think that feeling bad about their sin will make God happy. Religious people think that feeling bad makes God happy. It will atone for their sins. They'll bear their guilt on their own. Paul says, I'm not bringing you shame and correction. By the way, irreligious people don't like shaming at all. And when you try to correct your religious people, their response is, who do you think you are? To which Paul replies to the Corinthians, I am your father. You'll have many teachers, you'll have many tutors, you'll have many speakers, but you're only going to have one founding pastor. Paul says, I'm your father. I have apostolic authority in this place, and I bring correction. And anybody who loves another, whether it's a church, whether it's a family, whether it's a business, whatever it is, has to bring correction. The question is, how are we going to do it? Paul brings correction. I understand this. The correction of God is never shaming. It's about life change. It's never punitive. It's never punishment. God does not punish his children. He corrects them. He loves them. There's only one of his children he ever gave justice to. That was your older brother, Jesus. I think of the angry man whose son was injured. He was in the hospital. He was fighting for his life. And when the pastor came by to visit, he began to vent on the pastor. And finally he said, let me ask you this, pastor. Is God punishing my son for my sin? Which the pastor said, I'm not sure what God is doing, but this much I know. He is not punishing your son for your sin because he punished his son for your sin. So the correction of God is not punitive. It's not retribution. It's not, you owe me a pound of flesh and I'm going to get it. God is correcting us. He will correct. He will chasten. He will take his children to the woodshed if you have to. But all because he loves. Now when Paul corrects the church, he says, I don't want to shame you. And here's the key for those of us. We have to correct employees. We have to correct students. We have to correct children. Whenever you find yourself in the role of having to bring a word of correction, what would the Bible say? Correct as those who have received the grace and mercy of God. God did not shame you. God doesn't rub your nose in it. God doesn't let you have it. Correct with a tenderness. Correct with the notion that of all people, you, the corrector, have needed correction the most. The Bible says foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child, and it is. But guess where foolishness is more evident? In the heart of the parent. And so the parent has to realize, we're greater sinners than our children. We're far more sophisticated in our sins than children are. Our hearts are foul. We constantly need the correction of God. And so because of that, we don't abdicate and say, well, I can't discipline my kids because I'm not. No. You have no choice. You'll never be a worthy corrector. But God said, you're my agent. Correct your children. Discipline your children. Not because you qualify, but because you stand in my place. Correct them. But when you correct them with the understanding that you are the most in need of correction. What a difference, huh? Remember this week, a couple weeks ago, Ryan mentioned it last week in a sermon, the girl who just was beating her kid and they caught it on video. Remember what her name was? Miss Too Good. Too Good was too bad that day. So how could somebody beat their kid like that? You're wailing on their kid. Why don't you say something? Well, don't be too proud. Because we all do it. Maybe not with our fists. But we can do it with our words. We can do it with our looks. We can do it with our withdrawal. We can do it with our coldness. We beat people up. Don't we? Because we forget that we've been the objects of graciousness that we did not deserve. A number of years ago, I remember my oldest son did something really bad, and so it was one of those moments. I'm the dad, I've got to discipline, you know, right? It's kind of, you know, grounding. What rule we apply is, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't. So I went into his bedroom for the meeting, and when we sat down to talk, my son was mortified at what he had done. He was embarrassed at what he had done. He was ashamed, but I knew what he had done. And I just, it was so different. I sat, found myself sitting there saying, how do I give the gospel to my son? Not how do I give the law to my son. How do I tell my, you know, son, you did this, therefore you can't do this, you can't go out this weekend, you can't do this, and just realizing, I don't think any of that's going to reach him. And as he sat there, and I sat there, and I began to tell him how when I was his age, I did the same thing he had done. In fact, I had done it worse. And so that I was going to have to discipline him. But when I did understand that, you know, we were both going to go repent together before God. Because this didn't come from a father who was better than he was. It was a bigger screw-up than he was. I don't know, something happened that day. I remember almost walking out of his room, and it was almost like I had to say, Dad, so what is that I'm not allowed to do? I mean, what is, It was like any of that, you can't go out this weekend, you're grounded. It just didn't even matter. It didn't even matter. That wasn't the point. He wanted to do what was right. And so as we correct as those who have been so gently, tenderly corrected by our Father. That's Father love. Our culture needs it. Our businesses, our offices need it. Our schools need it. And thirdly, Father love embraces the call to sacrifice. The Corinthians saw the good life as being wise, powerful, elite, top-notch, high status. They were embarrassed by Paul's simple oratory and humble position. Look at how Paul describes his ministry in verse 9. I think God has exhibited us apostles, last of all, as men condemned to death. We have become a spectacle to the world. You know what he's talking about? The Roman victory procession, in which when the Romans won a conquest into the city, when they returned, would come the conquering general, and everyone would cheer, and in would come the army, and everyone would cheer, and then in would come all the booty, all the plunder. And all that was brought in, everybody would cheer and be all excited, and the women and the slaves and everything else they captured. And at the very end of the whole parade would come the king or the soldiers that were being disgraced. And they would be dragged in shackles. And the crowd would spit on them and throw garbage and boo. And they would be led to their execution. Also, that's our life. That's the life of the apostles. That's what life as a follower of Jesus looks like. The Corinthians saw the good life, the life that God wanted to have, is the life of status, being elite, being prestigious. The Corinthians said, the life God has for us is winning the Heisman Trophy. God says, no, really, I have more in mind you being the water boy. The Corinthians saw parade All-Americans. God says, no, I want you to sweep out the locker room. That's what I want. That's what I want in my picture, the character. Paul describes his life. Look at verse 11 in Paul. And he describes his life. We are hungry, thirsty, poorly clothed, roughly treated, homeless. We toil with our own hands, reviled, persecuted, slandered. Now here's a question. Ready? So, like, here's a Bible interpretation question. When Paul describes his life, is that descriptive? That's all. It's just a description of his life, but it has no application for us. Or is it prescriptive? Whenever you read the Bible, you have to determine that. You read some historical account of something, you say, okay, was that just their life? God had that for them? But that has no application to our life. Is this descriptive or is it prescriptive? Is there anything in this passage that would give us the idea that Paul's life is a prescription for our life? Anything in the passage? Perhaps two words? Imitate me. Imitate me. Paul says, you want a picture of the gospel life? This is what it looks like. I'm imitating Jesus. What did his life look like? He was not esteemed. He was not valued. He was not one to look at. He was shamed. He was humiliated. He was a fool. He left everything. He left heaven. He left glory. He left comfort. He left pleasure. He left prestige. And he became an absolute nobody who had no home, no possessions. Nothing. He was scorned, and they hung him on a tree, naked, and they spat on him, and they jeered him. When Paul says, I've become a spectacle to the world, he says, I am what? I am imitating Christ. And so what's the great challenge for us? Are we? What's the goal of life? In North America, and I can tell you what the goal of life is. In North America, the goal of life is personal convenience and comfort. All of life is engineered that way. We want a car that has shock absorbers. Ooh, we don't want a bump. We want a car with climate control and heated cushions, you know. And we want a car with defrost in the window. Ooh, we don't want to go out and scrape the window. You know, we want CD players and all that. And that's our car. That's just when we travel to and fro so that we don't get sweaty. And in our homes, you know, we have air filters and air cleaners. And should anything ever intrude in our life, we have insurance. right, to cover all of that. Everything's covered, everything's corrected, everything, so we could live in this, in a world of personal convenience and comfort is the highest value in North America. I have to ask, is it the goal of your life? Is it the goal of your life? Pleasure, comfort, convenience. Because Paul says that the very things that ought to define our lives are suffering, hardship, and inconvenience, because our lives are to be conformed to the cross. Paul says the desire of my life is that I might know Jesus, and I might know the power of his resurrection, and I might know the fellowship of his love. Suffering. The question for us is, and Paul says we're considered fools. Would anybody consider us a fool? Would anybody look at our life and say, I mean, remember 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul's going to say, if the resurrection isn't true, Christians are of all men most to be pitied. I mean, if you put all your money on the wrong horse, I guess what I'm asking is, would anyone look at your life and say, they have so clearly bet everything on Jesus? It's a matter of having passion. Father leadership has experienced the passion that God had, that Jesus Christ would become an absolute fool. And so we can't live life dispassionate about Jesus. If you've experienced it, then you parent with passion, and you spend with passion, and you live with passion because you tasted of a passionate love for you. What does it mean to be a fool for God? What does it mean to provide sacrificial leadership that others would look at and follow? In our culture, I know what it looks like in the military. Sure, dive on the grenade. Charge the enemy first. Put yourself out front. I know what that looks like, but I'm not sure what... Oh, boy, it's hard to know what it looks like in the office and in the home, isn't it? And in the culture and in our neighborhood. What does it look like? I know it has something to do with taking last place. That's why I know that when this service is over, we'll put the weights in the chairs away faster than we ever do. Because at the end of the 10:30 service, every week we have that great test. Who will take the lowest place? Who will say, I go to church, you know, it's a test every week. So this week's going to be a snap. I just know it. Who will take the lowest place? Who will change the diaper? Who will fold the laundry? Who will make himself of no account? Who will love the unlovely? Instead of surrounding ourselves with people that we like. Who will make room in their life for people who are perhaps difficult? Who will offer up their life to God and say, whatever hardship it is to me? Because very often it isn't so much that we offer our life to him, he just takes it, right? But when he takes it, who will give it willingly? Think of Hosea in the Bible. You know what God said to Hosea? I want you to marry a whore. I don't want to. She's going to be unfaithful. When she's unfaithful, I want you to go get her out of another man's bed, out of another man's arms, and bring her back and love her. I'm not available. Matter of fact, when she gets so bad and so wayward and so lost that she's naked on the slave block being sold as a prostitute, I want you to go down and outbid everyone else. God, I don't want my life to be an object lesson. God says to Hosea, I want your life to be a picture of the way that I love you. You love this unworthy woman because you've been loved by me, and you're far more unworthy than she ever has been. Your whole life I want it to be an object lesson. And so, you know, you've got cancer, or you've got an ailment, or you have a rotten marriage, or you have some slight in your life, and you say, why am I bearing this? I want to say to you, bear it with joy. Count yourself worthy to share in the sufferings of Christ. And say, whatever in my life stinks, thank you, Lord. If I bear it, I bear it for your glory. That the world might see that I am a fool who is passionate for you. I don't love you because you make my life work. And one of the places that's borne out often is how we handle our finances. Where our money flows freely, that's usually what we think is most valuable in our world. I was thinking this week, very often when we go on vacation or we go out to eat or something like that, and we get back, we say, what a day, you know. I spent too much. We just got into it, got carried away. I can't believe everything we spent. Maybe when people go shopping, that happens. I was wondering, how often do people walk out of church and say, oh man, you spent too much in there. Well, you gave way more than... Is there anybody who ever gives to Jesus that later says that? Have you ever made any sacrifice, any exertion where you later said, gave too much? Somehow or another, we have to say, how do I become a... I want to be counted among the fools for Jesus. William Borden of Yale, back in about the 1920s, the heir of the Borden family's fortune today would be about $30 million. He was converted in college. He would go to the Bowery Mission in New York City and ministering to the men there, changed his whole life. When he graduated from college, he gave away the entire fortune and he went as a missionary to the Coffin Corner of Africa. The Coffin Corner was the part of Africa where missionaries went. The average lifespan of a missionary was 6 months. They died. They got diseases they hadn't body had no resistance for. So when they shipped over there, they shipped their belongings in a coffin so that 6 months later they could be, their body could be shipped back in the same coffin. William Borden made it 17 months before he died. He was an heir to a fortune, to everything, the world at his footsteps. He threw it all away for Jesus. They found in his journal these 6 words. Shortly before he died, he wrote, no retreat, no reserve, no regret. What a fool. Oh, may God allow that someday you and someday I would be called fools as well.